This is the current federal tax developments for the week of March the 24th, March 25th, we'll make that, 2024. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by Kaplan Financial Education and by your state society of CPAs. I'm Ed Zollers, and this we're going to look at what's been going on in the area of federal taxes. And first we're going to start with is the ERC voluntary compliance program wound down this past week, and the IRS announced what they expect to see as future plans for the program. The Senate Finance Committee Chair, Senator Wyden from Oregon, indicates that there will be a cloture vote, or at least that he has 60 votes, he thinks, to allow the House-passed tax bill to go to the floor. The timing of it is somewhat uncertain, and I wouldn't be expecting it to come through this week. The IRS has issued proposed regulations to add a single premium annuity, charitable remainder annuity trust transaction to the list of listed transactions, and we'll talk about that. We've actually talked about this particular promoted program a couple of times already on the program. This would formally make it into a listed transaction. Previously, we discussed when the IRS had received some of the marketing materials and they wrote an internal memo. We talked about a tax court case that ruled against the program, and now the IRS wants to take this all the way up to make it into a listed transaction, imposing significant penalties if you fail to disclose you're part of one of these. And finally, the IRS has decided to ask U.S. Supreme Court to overturn the Culp decision from the Third Circuit Court of Appeals that deals with whether you really have only 90 days to file your tax court petition, or do you have 90 days at least, but if you have a really, really, really good reason and it would be equitable to allow you longer, can you get an extension on that? Third Circuit said yes. The tax court has said no. And the IRS now is asking the Supreme Court to step in and essentially settle this dispute. So let's start with the Employee Retention Credit Voluntary Disclosure Program. The IRS noted this week in their news release 2024-78, issued on March the 22nd, and entitled IRS Employee Retention Credit Program Compliance Effort Tops $1 billion Threshold Since Fall. Voluntary Disclosure Program Suspended After March 22nd, well, now after that date. Special Withdrawal Program Remains Open as Audits Investigations Intensify. Now, if you weren't aware, the IRS had announced 3 months ago a short-term voluntary disclosure program for returning funds that had been already received by the employer under the employee retention credit. If an employer did not want to take their chance with having the return examined or having the claims examined now and potentially having to pay back the funds plus interest and penalties, the IRS opened up a program that for 3 months and 3 months only allowed taxpayers to pay back effectively 80% of any quarter's ERC that they felt they didn't qualify for. And then, essentially, if they did that, they didn't have to worry about paying back any interest, including interest that they had received when they received the refund, but also interest then from the date of the refund until the date they paid back the IRS, nor did they need to worry about penalties. However, they had to basically give a nice list of all the individuals involved in the claim. So the promoters and other entities that might have been involved in preparing the claim. And then also, they got no protection from criminal charges, which was also a weird side effect of this. But presumably, we expect that is because having to turn in your promoter, we may very well find the promoter will then turn in dirt on the customer. And now the IRS has to decide who really was acting in a crooked fashion. So, yeah, I expect that's there. In any event, it's too late to be part of that program now. So if your client had never made up their mind and just couldn't decide if they wanted to do it, well, decision has now been made. You can't do this program, right? They did announce that the withdrawal program, you know, will continue. Now, that's a secondary program where if a employer has filed an employee retention tax credit claim, but the IRS has not yet paid the claim, right? Or if they paid it, the taxpayer has not cashed the check. and the taxpayer has not been notified that their claim, you know, in essence, been referred for criminal prosecution, you could essentially withdraw the claim. Now, in this program, just like with voluntary disclosure, this was an all or nothing deal for each quarter. You couldn't go back in and reduce a claim for a credit. You know, if you found out that, wait, okay, we claimed this credit, we claimed more than we should have, then you have to go through and do just a brand new revised return, you know, revised amended return, and then file that in and attempt to modify your claim. But that's not available here. So this was an all or nothing. Now, obviously, the withdrawal program only works as long as you haven't gotten the check. Only works as long as, or should say, as long as you have not cashed the check, if you got the check, right? So you need to be aware of those issues when we talk about the program. They indicated currently, since the initiatives were announced beginning back in September, when they announced the voluntary withdrawal program or the suspension followed by the voluntary withdrawal program, from the time these programs have been announced until March 22nd, the date of the news release, that they have brought in $1 billion, apparently, of ERC claims, which sounds like a lot of money. Well, it is a lot of money, except it's not a huge proportion of the entire ERC claims out there, or even the claims that we strongly get the feeling IRS suspects are abusive, shall we say, major problems. So, yeah, I honestly think there are a couple of problems with the program. While it was very generous at the 80% payback level, the fact it did not insulate you from criminal prosecution for coming in voluntarily, you know, and yeah, it just seemed like, well, don't know if you want to take that risk or not. Not because you expect it, but certainly you need to seek legal counsel to see if you appeared to be the sort of situation that counsel believed the IRS might target for criminal prosecution. And you also had to turn in all the promoters. Right. And that does indicate that there's a reasonable chance promoters might decide to claim you misled them. So there are all kinds of little quirks there. Now, the voluntary withdrawal program does not require you to do anything like that. Basically, it gets you out of it. You just withdraw the claim. You're not telling them any details. You're just giving a notice of withdrawal. So that program is there. But the problem is, of course, that program is no longer, you know, is basically not going to give you any break. You didn't get to keep 20%. Now, they did indicate the voluntary disclosure program could continue at a future date. It appears that to some extent, they're saying, you know, will it continue under the same terms? Would it continue under less favorable terms? A lot of this may depend upon whether Congress extends the statute. Right, the statute for the 2020 returns is going to end relatively soon here at April 15th of 2020, you know, of 2024. We're going to close the statute for the most part on a lot of those claims from 2020. That's the last day to file, apparently, also. So a lot of claims will be closing off at that point, or you've got to be within 2 years of the date you filed for it. So depending upon when you filed for the claim or got the claim at least paid back, IRS may be running out of time, except for the potential for a five-year statute if it was the item was obtained via misleading information. So we don't know how the IRS is going to pursue that or whether they are going to impute, which I suspect they're going to try at least, impute bad faith actions by the promoter or the person who was preparing the returns. Those could be imputed back to the employer because they do have some case law that have allowed that to happen in other contexts that make us a little bit afraid that they're going to go there here. The IRS did indicate that they're going to intensify the review of ERC claims, including audits, promoter investigations, and criminal investigations. And here, of course, they do their saber rattling, noting that they have had 25 criminal cases brought already. Where charges filed. 12 of those have resulted in convictions, and the average sentence has been 24 months for those convicted. So one of those things to look at. Please note that, and it's what I've been told by the Criminal Investigation Division people, and what appears to happen when you actually read the cases, when they come down to the Justice Department news releases, Yeah, they're looking for cases that smell bad and could sell to a jury. So it's bad facts if your client, you know, got an ERC claim they obviously shouldn't have qualified for, especially if they, you know. So they're looking for people who are pushing the envelope more than just slightly. So they're looking at some heavy pushing, but they're also looking for conspicuous consumption type situations where they got the money back. It wasn't used to pay for anybody, any employees or anything. You know, it was simply used to go out there and splurge on, you know, luxury items. They like those cases. So understand that that's the sort of thing they tend to go criminal on. The processing moratorium they announced, which was announced early, was announced last year, the IRS has announced that that will continue into late spring for claims that were filed after the moratorium was announced. So they're going to keep processing those claims that were filed before. It was September 16th, I believe, the day of the moratorium. They're going to keep processing those returns, but they're not yet ready to restart the other package. And late spring conceivably means we could be all the way into mid-June. You know, because, you know, remember, summer starts June 20-something. Don't remember the date exactly right now. So theoretically, they could be pushing all the way out to, you know, into June before they're going to actually start picking up claims that were filed on or after the date they announced the moratorium. And I've certainly heard from people that have some claims outstanding and CPAs with clients with claims outstanding that, yeah, there's not been a lot of movement. So it's going to be a very, very slow process from here forward. I think that's probably not surprising to anybody, but definitely the way it is. Now, we had an update this week in an article in Tax Notes Today, published on March 22nd, written by Doug Sword. It says, cloture vote on tax package looking more likely. Now, a cloture vote is something that happens in the United States Senate. And if you're not aware of Senate rules, for most things in the U.S. Senate, before the Senate can vote on something, they have to go through a rule. Then this is a modified version of the old filibuster concept. But in essence, to bring a motion to the floor to vote on, you have to have 60 senators agree that it will be brought up for a vote. Now, over time, this has been, to be quite honestly, weaponized over the years. And in that sense means, so the minority party, or party not in control of the Senate, basically has decided that that means as long as we have 41 votes, that we can vote no, right? Long, long ago, filibusters were a rarity. And even when they went to the 60-vote cloture, which meant we weren't going to make people talk forever, it was practical matter. We still didn't see very often where they wouldn't let something go to a vote in the Senate. But as things become more partisan over the past few decades, whoever the minority party is has been more than willing to use the cloture vote process to ensure that anything they oppose doesn't come to the floor unless they get certain concessions. And that has been true in both Republican and Democrat minority periods in the Senate. We've had both. So this point, obviously, since the Democrats barely control the Senate, it would be the Republicans that would be the issue for a cloture vote. Because obviously, cloture vote means that we have opposition from a significant portion of the minority party, and that significant portion is going to vote no, right, and will not let this come to the floor. So it was interesting this week when finally Senate Finance Committee Chair Wyden just announced that he believes there are 60 votes to move it through. Now, most people would take that as a veiled threat to bring the matter to the floor, and Democratic leadership has taken some preliminary steps to move that way. That is per Senator Crapo, the ranking Republican member of the Senate Finance Committee. It's kind of obvious. Yeah, that's what you would expect. Now, Senator Crapo did decline to predict the outcome of such a vote if it went to the floor. You know, that's not clear. He said a majority of his caucus is against doing this. But remember, you could have still a majority of the caucus, but not necessarily not be able to hold the 9 votes, right? In essence, so Republicans currently have 49 members. Well, if 40 of the 49 members were opposed to the bill and would vote no on allowing it to go to the floor to vote, and 9 aren't opposed to the bill, or in fact in favor of the bill, and they will vote to let it go forward, you could still lose the vote. So it could be interesting for a number of reasons, and I think this is kind of what Senator Crapo is referring to. There are a lot of business provisions, actually 3 key ones in that bill, that there has been some heavy lobbying to get that to pass. And that particular rule, you know, involved the bonus is basically the research and development expensing issue. The 163J interest deduction rules, rolling them back to what we had before 2022, you know, rolling back to prior to those rules where we didn't have to worry about depreciation, amortization, depletion. And finally, beginning in 23, the drop down of bonus depreciation to 80% from 100 and then continuing on for the next couple of years. All 3 of those are dealt with in the bill the House passed overwhelmingly. However, as noted in the Senate, not necessarily been as clear that that was going to work. This is majorly, shall we say at this point, a political game. You know, there is a negotiating deal where Senator Crapo would like to see certain changes, so would certain other Republicans. Senator Wyden had announced earlier in the week that, you know, what they were asking for would be a poison pill to the Democrats in the Senate. So there's no point in going through some of the things they're asking for, but they are still at least apparently negotiating on some options. Senator Wyden has claimed that he has offered to take the 1-year look back out of the law for the child, for the refundable child tax credit. But as Senator Crapo notes, that offer is that they'll take the money saved from not allowing you to look back a year and use that to increase the amount of the credit that is refundable. Now, when I think about that, that makes some sense. Not saying as a policy matter, good or bad. I'm just saying that since this deal was, you know, we're going to spend X dollars on things the Democrats want, and we'll spend an identical number of dollars on the things the Republicans want, and that's how we'll make this work. Now, I think the Republicans may be gambling, which might not be a bad idea, that there are definitely Democrats who are going to be nervous that, you know, if in fact the business provisions aren't voted for, because they, remember, they had enough support, at least the R&D one did, that we were all, you know, it basically went through the failed bill, that, you know, the Build Back Better Act. It was in there to fully restore expensing for R&D. And that was a bill that was expected to be passed solely with Democrat votes, eventually was, as a much reduced bill called the Inflation Reduction Act, which, by the way, pulled out the R&D to reduce the cost of the bill. So that's going to be part of the trade-off. So again, it's a political move. I guess the good news is it appears that the idea is they're trying to work to get it passed. The bad news is I don't know if anybody's going to blink. And if we're going to just switch over to, well, let's try to blame, you know, the other side for things failing. But keep your eye on this, at least if it goes, because what would be the simplest approach would be you go to a vote on the floor of the Senate. You know, we go there, the cloture vote passes. The bill that passed the House is brought up before the Senate, you know, does, you know, and they pass it with no modifications. That bill would go directly to the president's desk. There's no other steps involved. If we do modify the bill, let's say we do what the Republicans are asking on the Senate Finance Committee, if that happens, then the bill, okay, let's say it does go through, it passes the Senate, but now it has to go to conference. And it also means it's going to have to pass another vote in the House, which may or may not be simple to do, right? Got it through once, and I realize it was by a big margin, but again, it's risking things, especially if they do go forward with throwing out a speaker again, because remember, that just stops the House from pretty much doing anything while that's going on. You know, is that going to happen? Will this be there? And, you know, and the other quirk involved, which on that threat, is that with the latest resignation of a member of Congress, right now the Republicans, if two Republicans defect, essentially, then we're going to get a tie vote on anything if the Democrats all vote the other way and two Republicans join them. And the issue is, and if three Republicans come out basically and join the Democrats and vote whatever way against something, like against retaining the speaker, then that'll pass because that's all you need, right? Because the margins are so tight right now. As I said, becoming tight and a real problem right now to get things through. And yeah, that's another mess. Next up, we have proposed regulation 1.6011-15, Federal Remainder Annuity Trust Listed Transaction is the title of it. And this proposed reg was put in the Federal Register, or will be, on March the 25th. Now, what the IRS is proposing, adding arrangements using a single premium annuity product in a charitable remainder annuity trust. And so that's basically a SPA, single purpose, you know, single payment annuity. And a charitable remainder annuity trust is, we'll call, a CRAT, right? Put that on the list of listed transactions. Now, how this is marketed to people, and you'll see it, is that they come in and say, well, form a charitable remainder annuity trust. Now, anybody who's ever done a charitable remainder trust knows that you basically, the standard structure is you're going to use it to dispose of some highly appreciated assets that you might have. And the idea being you can get a current charitable contribution deduction, or in the other variant, you could get an estate tax deduction for the present value of the future amount being left to the charity after the annuity payout comes in based on the federal law assumptions of interest rates earned inside the plan or inside the trust, you know, on that current date. You look those up and you use them. You know, and then also that gain is not currently taxed inside the trust, but as the payments come out year after year, those payments are considered to first distribute types of income in the trust. And we have different layers, but generally higher rate things come out first. So let's say that you had a highly appreciated, let's say, piece of real estate. You decide you want to do a CRAT. You heard about it. You like the idea. We're going to go ahead and have this big gain. We're going to reinvest the money. We're going to then, you know, pay that money out of the trust, you know, an annuity payment. So a portion of it goes to charity, at least 10% present value goes to charity. And the rest present value can be effectively expected to be paid out to us as the annuity. And we don't pay immediate tax on the capital gain inside the trust, but every year as we get a distribution from the CRAT, that distribution to pay the annuity amount is considered to take out those layers in order. So at the very least, we're going to pay capital gains rates on that distribution, is the way the idea goes, until we've basically paid out more than the capital gain. And most likely we'll pay a bit more than that because it's very likely that the trust will have other types of income, interest, et cetera. They're going to do something with that money that you got from selling the property. Well, what the promoters argue in this case is because we're using a single premium annuity product, that annuity product owned by the CRAT is going to be taxed to the beneficiary of the trust under the standard Section 72 rules. And that means that, you know, you go and you buy an annuity, you pay $200,000 for an annuity, one big premium up front, and then it's going to pay you however many dollars per month for life. And under the single premium annuity rules, you're going to consider each payment to be made up of interest and a bit of, you know, let's say not interest, it could be interest as we do it, but whatever. You're going to consider each of those payments to be made up of earnings and then a recovery of principal under the single premium annuity. Now, the problem, as the IRS pointed out, is that in this case, the taxpayer doesn't own the annuity and they effectively liquidated an asset to buy the annuity. And that liquidation creates a capital gain. The CRAT rules require the various levels to go through. So the mere fact that the CRAT may be getting the money to pay out to the annuitant from the single premium annuity is irrelevant. It's money deemed to come from the CRAT. The CRAT would pick up the earnings there, right, inside it. So like the interest portion, but that would just go into another layer. And then the actual amount paid out to the beneficiary would carry out the appropriate layers. And that's what the IRS says, that's how it's going to work. So that's the problem. Okay, as we go on to this issue. Now, with their claim, generally, you would never end up with a capital gain realized upon the sale of asset. And their argument is to ignore the 72 thing sometimes, but more. Well, they claim really that that applies because when you gift the asset to the general remainder trust, there's a step up in basis, which, by the way, I have no idea. I've read some of the memos and it's like, huh? You know, yeah, they're misreading various things to make this work, but that's what they do. Now, we did discuss this issue twice before. Last year, on just about a little less than a year ago, 11 months ago, effectively, in Gerhardt versus Commissioner, we discussed a taxpayer who had actually put together one of these structures and the IRS challenged them in tax court. And the taxpayer in Gerhardt lost. Okay, so there's a loss. This is 160 TC number 9 case from last April. But even before that, 3 years earlier, we had a memorandum, AM 2020-006, which where the IRS got some of the marketing materials that was being used to push this and gave their own critique. What I'll say is that in Gerhardt, the tax court basically agreed with the IRS analysis entirely. Thus, yeah, it didn't work. Now they want to make it into a listed transaction. Remember, with a listed transaction, every year there is an impact on the return from the transaction. With a CRAT, that's going to be every year you get a payment from the CRAT, and every year the trust has some sort of income recognition situation. You're going to have to file an 8886 every year to notify the IRS. Promoters have to file notifications with the IRS as well and maintain lists of people they've sold this to, right? So this is considered to be a, you know, very good warning that the IRS considers this to be something you shouldn't be doing. And they're going now, you know, there was a court case a couple of years ago where they held that the IRS had to go through a proposed regulation, had to go effectively through a regulation process to add to list of transactions. So that's why we're seeing it this way. My gut reaction is that we're probably going to just see this roll into the regs and it will become a listed transaction. So if you have a client that has done one of these, remember when something gets added to the list of listed transactions, that means that we then end up having to pick that up and go back and amend any returns with open statutes that were impacted by it. And we have to file that notice within 90 days of the date that it becomes a listed transaction. So if this becomes final and any client has done anything like this, yeah, they're going to have to go out and file that as well. And again, remember, if you don't do it, you don't file it, two really bad things happen to you. Number one, the statute of limitations doesn't start on the transaction until such time as you filed the required notification. And then number two, regardless of whether or not let's say this works, which would be really interesting to see a court decides this works. But even if a court were to decide it worked, that doesn't change the fact you have a penalty equal to 75% of the tax benefits that you are scheduled to receive. And that can make it a very, very expensive proposition. So, yeah, you know, we have a little bit of fun here with the CRAT announcement as we have it. Finally, we have the IRS filing a petition for a writ of certiorari in the Commissioner versus Culp case that we discussed a while back here. This was filed on March 18th. The question decided in the Third Circuit's Culp case was, is Section 6213 90-day deadline to file in the tax court for a due determination of a tax deficiency a hard and fast deadline? In essence, is a 90-day letter literally 90 days, and you don't make the 90th day, Tough luck, guys. You can't go to tax court, right? The Third Circuit in Culp answered that, no, it's not a hard and fast deadline. They looked to a Supreme Court ruling from 2022 in Betchler PC versus Commissioner, which involved a collection due process redetermination hearing. And there the statute talks about 30 days to file the tax court. Now, the Third Circuit decided, applying the Supreme Court's analysis in Betchler, that the regular, the regular date for challenging a tax deficiency in tax court could also be available for more than the 30 days or 90 days if equity demanded that it be done that way. So, in essence, rather than being a hard and fast deadline, the 30-day rule is, you know, a basically safe harbor, because beyond that date, you've got to show that there is good cause for why you weren't able to file on time, and therefore why the court should allow you to still bring your challenge. Now, the IRS recognizes that obviously the IRS upheld Betchler, but they're saying that the 90-day letter rule is fundamentally different. That's one of their key issues. Now, in a later decision, which was Sanders v. Commissioner, which is an unusual case for a couple of odd reasons, not the least which is Sanders didn't raise the Culp issue. The court did kind of invent it on its own, not invent it, but decided to discuss it on its own, did its own writing and research, and then came to a conclusion. And this was a pro se taxpayer who had no representation. So you might cynically believe the tax court did that knowing that this would not be appealed to a court of appeal. In essence, the taxpayer is not going to run the appeal of this thing, and therefore they'd be able to hold up and effectively say that, you know, we're not following Culp except in the cases where we have to. Now, where they have to is still in the Third Circuit. Under the Golson rule, the tax court must follow binding precedent that exists in the circuit where the taxpayer resides, right? So the taxpayer brings this case in, you know, the U.S. tax court. The taxpayer lives in New Jersey. Then Third Circuit says, hey, you're going to have a chance to, you know, argue for, you know, some sort of equitable relief because you couldn't meet the 90-day term. If your taxpayer lives in Arizona, tough luck. You know, beyond day 90, the tax court is going to deny and throw out your petition. And the only way you can get it back would be to litigate on your own up to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals and then see what they think. And repeat that for all of the other 12 circuits. Actually 13, but I don't know if the Federal Circuit ever get involved in this. You know, repeat that for every circuit, and you could see there'd be a lot of cases that would need to go through to determine if the other circuits are going to follow this rule. IRS would like this to be done because it's not optimal to have two sets of rules, which is what we practically do at this point until somebody takes it in the other circuits up to the Court of Appeals. And then if those courts don't start agreeing, then we could still continue to have a very different set of rules in different basically circuits. So we'll see what happens. My catch is I'm not sure the Supreme Court is going to consider this ripe for consideration. You know, they told in Betchler, they try to explain how to analyze whether something is, as they'll refer to it, jurisdictional, which means the 90-day deadline would be absolute, or whether it's not jurisdictional, and therefore standard rules of equity can apply in determining if we should be, the taxpayer should be allowed to go beyond day 90 and file their petition later. The Supreme Court may prefer, while the IRS is trying to say there's a split in the circuits, they are basing it upon the fact that all of the rulings from the courts before Betchler went to the Supreme Court essentially said that these things were jurisdictional. So we don't know that, let's say, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals would consider post-Betchler or the, for basically their prior decision still to be valid. Or would they say, nope, given the analysis in Betchler we have to follow, we're not going to go back and say, yeah, we agree as well that this is not a jurisdictional rule. It is one where we can apply equitable principles. So keep an eye on this one. It opens up some, probably not a huge number of doors, but at least gives some hope if a client ends up in a position where they've ignored a 90-day letter. You know, you haven't, they don't get it. They don't act, call anybody until after day 90's gone by. In that situation, then this could be helpful if the Supreme Court picks this up and they rule. But again, likely such a ruling would not come until sometime, probably middle of next year, if they pick it up. And there's no guarantee they pick it up. They may just wait for the circuits to see if the thing resolves itself, because they never do tend to like tax cases. Okay, this has been the current federal tax developments for the week of March the 25th, 2024. Last March session for this. We are heading into April. Yes, isn't that wonderful? April 15th is almost upon us. It's a real April 15th this year. Okay, as always, I do, you know, look at emails if they come in on the edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com mailbox. I also follow along on discussions on the Connect sites for Arizona, New Jersey, Idaho, Illinois, Minnesota, Washington. So you can keep your eye there. And I do post tax updates on Threads if you're there. So at Ed Zollers is the name. You can find things there. Otherwise, I'll see you guys back here next week. And we'll talk about whatever else is going on in the area of current federal tax developments.